This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Jim Lafferty from California joins us to talk about the recent surge of people taking it to the streets.
4 million of them, 2 days after Trump was inaugurated. What does it mean? Where should we go from here?
We'll talk about the status of drug policy reform in the United States with some predictions of what may come under the Trump administration.
Our guest is Drug Policy Alliance founder and director Ethan Nadelman. To our way of thinking, the real drug czar.
We'll examine the Trump administration's position on a two-state solution in Israel and Palestine.
Is the two-state solution dead? If there can only be one state, what sort of state will it be?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Last week, President Trump restarted the Dakota Area Pipeline Project and also the Keystone XL Pipeline, which will bring dirty tar sand oil from Canada through the USA to the Gulf of Mexico for export. According to Jim Hansen, the former climate expert at NASA, if this happens, it will be, in his words, game over for the planet. We just learned that Trump is about to sign a package of executive orders building the wall between us and Mexico, threatening Muslims, Arabs, refugees, children, and immigrants. The Women's March last week after Trump had been in office but for 2 days brought out some 4 million people across the country. 500,000 in Washington, D.C., 750,000 in Los Angeles. We speak today with Los Angeles National Lawyers Guild leader, attorney Jim Lafferty, who helped organize the demonstration out there. Jim Lafferty is the former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and a leader of the Los Angeles chapter. His radio show on KPFK inspired Law and Disorder. Attorney Jim Lafferty has been active since the civil rights movement in the South in the 1960s and was a leader of the movement against the war in Vietnam. Jim Lafferty, nice to have you on Law and Disorder again.
Oh, good to talk to you always.
Jim, you had a central role in the organizing of the demonstration in L.A., and it was just an amazing outpouring. What did you think of it all?
Well, it was quite amazing. We had two amazing days, actually. On Inauguration Day itself, we had probably 25,000, 30,000 in a pouring rain, and I do mean pouring rain, of flooded streets and what have you. And then, of course, the Women's March the following day, Saturday, the police here estimated probably had about 700, 750,000 people, which is extraordinary.
And it's extraordinary, Jim, because the police estimates are usually lowball.
Yeah. Well, we do have a somewhat healthier relationship here with the police than I think some cities do. And it was pretty hard to miss that one. We had one demonstration in 2006, immigrant rights demonstration. The police acknowledged we had 1 million people on the streets. That's the largest demonstration we've ever had in L.A. on May Day. This had that kind of feel to it. It wasn't quite as big, and so I think the 700 or 750,000 was probably pretty accurate. When you put that together with the hundreds of thousands that were demonstrating in some of the other major cities in the country, and let's not forget what was going on all over the world, I suspect it was perhaps the largest day of protest in the history of the world. One should certainly look into that. I think that might well have been the case.
That's a pretty remarkable observation.
Yeah, well, Hump can chalk that up to his ego. He drew out the most people ever against him.
Yeah, well, that's right. Whatever he kept saying, he was going to have the largest people at his inauguration. I was confident of that too, but not in the sense that he was. He's a sick fellow. We kid about it, but it's nothing funny about it. The man is obviously mentally ill. People who study these things more from a professional point of view have pointed out his apparent mental illnesses. He's an inveterate liar. He can't stand to acknowledge any truth that doesn't stroke his ego. So it makes for not simply interesting times, but for dangerous, dangerous times ahead.
Yeah, that's for sure. A friend of mine who used to be a professor of psychiatry wrote a letter to his son in South Africa. You know, there are big demonstrations in South Africa.
And, yeah.
And my friend described to his son his professional opinion of the mental state of Donald Trump. And he said, quote, "The guy's really bonkers."
Well, that's as good a description as any.
But Jim, we don't want to continue on this vein. I think we all agree about this.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, what it was like at the demonstration in L.A.? What sort of people were there? Diversity, age. What was the feeling?
On both days, it was extremely diverse. Obviously, on Saturday, it was largely women, but men were well represented as well. Women of color, whether we're talking about African-American women or whether we're talking about L.A.'s huge immigrant rights population and immigrant population were represented as well. The camaraderie, it was difficult for many people. I mean, it was very hard to move, frankly. There was no front to the march. Because it came from every direction to assemble. And people were coming from every direction to assemble. I was, for reasons I won't bore you with, I was supposed to be at the front of this march, but there was no front. There was only a middle. And wherever you were, if you looked at it, and there are some aerial shots of it, because you could see that streets in every direction were filled going outward from a center. There were speeches given at City Hall. There were speeches given in another area of downtown. There were three or four rallies by the same demonstration in order to try to get a message out to everybody. And there were some powerful messages. Well, there were a lot of people from the city, politicians who gave the usual politician kinds of speeches. But folks like Jane Fonda gave, frankly, one of the best speeches I've ever heard her or anyone else give. We couldn't expect the politicians to do what we need done for us. We have to do it ourselves. We have to do it by being in the streets. The only things we've ever won of great significance in this country, whether it was ending wars or winning women's rights or civil rights for people of color, we've done ourselves because we've been in the streets of massive numbers over and over on a consistent basis. We've refused to leave those streets and stop our demonstrations until we've won whatever it was the issue of the day. Today, there are, under this administration, not one issue, but many issues. It isn't simply a matter of the war. It isn't simply a matter of civil rights. It's, as we know, and we could go through and check a long list of changes that of rights that we have in this country or of social programs that we have in this country that are under severe threat, of course, from this administration. We've seen that just in the last couple of days is issuing of an executive order defunding our programs all over the world that help the women and others if they so much as mention maybe you want to consider an abortion.
Jim, what's your assessment of the outpouring across the nation? Is there any trend that you see emerging?
Well, that's a harder. I've still been studying these demonstrations and getting the reports. The Lawyers Guild have legal observers at these demonstrations. We're getting reports, about what they were like. If you look at a map, the New York Times had a map the other day, putting in red everywhere that there was a demonstration. It pretty much looked like a solid nation of red. There were certainly some little towns in places where nobody was protesting, but frankly, they were hard to find. It was the most nationwide protest, I think it's fair to say, in the history of the country. From what I can tell, the demands were similar. I mean, they were, of course, central to Saturday was women's rights. But they talked about health care, they talked about the environment, they talked about protecting the rights of our immigrant sisters and brothers and so forth. It probably varied from area to area somewhat based on what the issue might have been in that particular area. But there was a universal sentiment that we don't want this country to go back. We want it to go forward in terms of human rights and taking care of the needs of the people.
So you're saying this? There was even a larger outpouring than during the anti-Vietnam War protest.
Oh, yes. There was no single day during Vietnam. April 24th, 1971, there were about 750,000 people or so in D.C. and about 350,000 in Washington. That's considered probably the single. And then some smaller protests. That was a million people plus. But we had far more than that in the United States on Saturday. My God. I mean, if you add the hundreds of thousands in New York and Washington, you know, we could go through it again. And, you know, and 10,000 in Denver or whatever it was, and 7,000 in this city. And, you know, San Luis Obispo, which is a town of 50,000 people in California, had something like 7,000 or 8,000 people demonstrating. I mean, you know, a town of 50,000. And again, those are not pie-in-the-sky figures. Those are actual figures. And if you look at the crowd size pictures, it confirms it. I mean, there's never been a day in this country when it was as united, if you will, not only in protest against a particular president, but united in demanding a just and humane society.
So where do we go from here?
Well, I think that's the big question. I don't think we can expect, you know, the millions of people are in the streets this last Saturday to come to the streets every time this president or this administration does something awful. I do know that groups like Planned Parenthood and the Greens and Move On and the Bernie Sanders, the more radical wing of the Bernie Sanders movement, you know, are talking about just that question: how do we sustain this? How do we get organized in such a way that we can, you know, call people back when we need to? They did something very brilliant in L.A. and I think in D.C. as well. They simply asked everybody to call a certain number. I don't understand this kind of phone technology, but thereby they got everybody's phone number in a very easy way. So they were very smart about it. We did a better job of finding out who was in the streets with us on Saturday than we generally do, and that's going to be very helpful in terms of local organizing. You know, a lot of states are localizing on the state level and the city level around certain issues. Where the federal government will not be so easy for Trump and the federal government to stop the progress or to roll back the progress that's been made. I'm hoping that out of this comes an awareness that we need a new political party. The wing of the Bernie Sanders movement that we worked with and organized along with ANSWER and other groups here in Los Angeles is the wing of that movement which understands it ought not to go into the Democratic Party, that we need a new People's Party, Workers' Party, call it what you will, a party that is at least as far left as the social democratic notions of Bernie Sanders. I found that very wholesome here. How that reflects all around the rest of the country is yet to be seen.
I just want to add, be careful that you don't share all that information electronically on the protesters, because these are times when lists are being collected by the NSA.
No, your wonderful book about all that, yes, that's a good point. How they're going to handle that is unclear to me. That's a very good point, but to the extent that I have contacts with people here, I will certainly pass that good message along, and you ought to stress it, and we'll stress it on the Lawyers Guild show out here as well.
Great. Okay, Jim, we want to stay in touch with you over the next few months, so don't go away, and thanks for all the excellent work you do.
Thanks, Jim, and be well.
You guys.
Yes. Big hugs.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Colonial Settler State of Israel was formed in 1948 pursuant to a declaration of the United Nations. The declaration also envisioned a Palestinian state, which has so far been prevented by Israel with the support of the United States. In 1967, the Israeli army captured the West Bank territory meant to be part of the Palestinian state and has, over the last 50 years, illegally ruled over 500,000 settlers who have been placed into the territory. Is it still possible to have a two-state solution in the Middle East? Is it too late? Have the number of settlers reached a critical mass so that the two-state solution is dead? Can the settlers be evacuated? If not, how can there be a Palestinian state? We speak today with journalist Phil Weiss, who founded 10 years ago and now co-edits
the influential, widely read blog Mondo Weiss. In the past, Weiss has worked as a mainstream journalist for the Minneapolis Star and the New York Observer, the newspaper owned by Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, who, when told that Phil was not a Zionist, told him, "You're fired."
Phil Weiss, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
What do you believe the Trump administration's position will be on a two-state solution and on settlements, considering that his appointee as ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, financially supports a settlement on the West Bank?
I think that the Trump administration will mark a break on the two-state solution in that it will do nothing, even lip service, to advance the two-state solution. So, and that will be a service in as much as the two-state solution has been dead for a long time. I don't think that Trump will be as hypocritical about it as past administrations. On the other hand, I don't think that Trump really cares much about this issue, and that he's parking David Friedman over there to keep him away. He understands that Friedman is a hothead, or he has to understand that Friedman is a hothead, and he's going to be parked over in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, wherever he'll be, and I don't think it's going to be a big part of Trump's foreign policy.
Despite his son-in-law?
I recognize that Jared Kushner, who fired me 10 years ago, cares a lot about this question and thinks he can bring about Middle East peace, but you know, Israeli society is going right-wing faster and faster by the second, and that's going to be the same crisis that that Barack Obama faced in dealing with the Israeli leadership. Trump's going to have some of that, too. It's not going to be easy dealing with Netanyahu and a right-wing. He's not just going to go along with these people. I don't think he will be able to, Trump.
Well, 2 weeks ago, Secretary of State John Kerry gave a speech denouncing the settlements and stating, quote, "The two-state solution is now in serious jeopardy." The Obama administration allowed a UN Security Council resolution on this to be passed. Talk about that. What's the meaning of that, if any?
Well, it's significant to Obama's legacy, such as it is, that at the last minute he allowed this resolution to go through, a resolution very similar to the one he vetoed 5 years ago, more than 5 years ago. So he began his administration by saying the settlements must end. He did nothing to end the settlements over the course of his administration, just gave more and more money to Israel. And then at the last minute, he allowed, by abstaining, this historic resolution against settlements, calling them in essence a war crime, as Norman Finkelstein says. He allowed that resolution to go through. So that is to his credit. John Kerry's statement is an accurate one. I mean, the two-state solution is already over. Kerry has also said we're looking at a one-state reality. I think that the death of the two-state solution is on a number of American politicians' resumes now, but Obama and Kerry, it's to their credit, too. They did nothing to try to rescue partition, partition is a done deal at this point. You have 600,000 settlers on east of the Green Line. They're never coming out of there, and we are looking at one state. So I find it, to answer your question, I find it extremely dispiriting that it would take him so long to put down a marker against Netanyahu, but he did finally do so.
Phil, what do you think about the future of the BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction movement in light of all of these developments?
That's a great question, and I think that that's really one place that I'm very hopeful. The BDS movement has been lifted up by these developments. BDS is sort of the only game in town in terms of forcing the Israelis to adhere to international law. And who else is doing anything? The Europeans are making a few gestures. We do have this resolution in the UN that some have called a eulogy for the two-state solution. One speaker after another bewailed the end of the two-state solution when that resolution was passed. And meanwhile, you have a Palestinian movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions that is now over 10 years old, that was animated by the ICJ, International Court of Justice, opinion on the wall of 2004 or 5. And BDS is gaining strength by the moment. And when you see Israel becoming more and more right-wing, what is the answer? It's just what justice and peace movements have always seen as the answer, and it's boycotting, it's divesting, it's sanctioning, and that's where the action is. And inasmuch as Israel has shown complete defiance of this latest UN resolution, where are we going to see the resistance? Well, the resistance is alive and well in this international solidarity movement that has coalesced around BDS.
Phil, if one state is now inevitable, what kind of state would it be? Can it be both Jewish and democratic at the same time?
I think that there was a time where Israel tried to balance those qualities of Jewish and democratic. I mean, obviously it's an oxymoron, but there are countries in the world that have a religious character. That time has passed. We are looking at a country that is an apartheid country, where one group of people, half the country basically, has no rights or fewer rights in some cases. Some are second-class citizens. Some are not citizens in any real respect because they can't even vote. And that status is awarded on a racial basis. And so you have a Jewish supremacist society. Now, that is the question. What will that one state look like? That your question is really the only real question that exists politically right now. And increasingly, we're going to see two sides in this struggle. We're going to see one side that rationalizes Jewish supremacy and says it's good for Palestinians, and Palestinians should be defeated and accept Jewish sovereignty, as Daniel Pipes puts it. And on the other side, we are going to see people, we're going to have a movement for equal rights.
The Zionist creation myth, the narrative it used to promote the settling and colonization of Palestine, was that it was a state without a people for a people without a state. Was this true?
It was not true. And obviously, Palestine was populated, or it should be obvious to people in the West now, that Palestine was populated by nearly a million Palestinians, or over a million at the time that partition was declared in 1947, and far fewer Jews. So when Israel Zangwill made that famous comment that you just quoted in the early days of Zionism, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living in Palestine, and few Jews, or I think close to 100,000 Jews. And so it was not true. Now, the thing that I think we can say somewhat excuses it is that it was of a piece with, you know, a lot of other Western sort of beliefs about the white man's burden or colonialist ideas. This is an ideology that we have taken apart in our generation, and that the left, I think nobly, has been against for decades. But at that time, I think that awareness was the Zionist colonialist awareness was, or colonialist project was not that different from many other Western projects. And I would add that there was a Jewish problem in Europe, unquestionably, and that for many, Zionism was a form of deliverance. So when people call Zionism a colonialist enterprise, I say yes, but it was also a deliverance enterprise. You know, people were immigrating because they felt unsafe, not unlike the way that people immigrate from unsafe societies and are refugees of unsafe societies today, and we honor that refugee impulse. The question is, what type of country, society they wanted to set up when they left Europe.
Phil, another question about Zionism. Tom Suarez, in a recent scholarly book, has written that, quote, Zionism, being a response to anti-Semitism and Jewish persecution, is a fraud. Indeed, quite the opposite. It thrives by exacerbating and capitalizing on these and has turned them into a cynical, deadly business. What's your thought on that observation?
I think that there's a lot of truth to what Tom says. He has a... I think his view of this is a little bit more black and white than mine. I try to be more nuanced about it, but there's no question that Zionism has fed off the existence of anti-Semitism, and when anti-Semitism seems to be on the wane, it stokes anti-Semitism. And so recently, Julia Yoffe, who's a writer at The Atlantic, and a leading kind of mainstream reporter on these issues, said she was, quote-unquote, glad when anti-Semitism reared its head in the United States this fall with attacks on Jewish journalists. The Anti-Defamation League documented the fact that there was a surge in threats and attacks on Jewish journalists this year. There's unquestionably anti-Semitism spiking in our country during this Trump liberation of demon forces. And Yoffe said she was glad that this was happening because it showed people that Jews were still a persecuted minority. And I think that that is part of the ideology of Zionism, that Jews are unsafe in the West, therefore we need a refuge. Zionism has never believed in integrating minorities into a country and giving them equal rights. So it doesn't like that. It likes Jewish nationalism in Palestine, and it likes other forms of nationalism in the West. And that's why David Friedman, the settler hero who's going to be the next ambassador, if Trump has his wish, to Israel, that's why David Friedman is perfectly comfortable with Trump, and why so many Zionists are perfectly comfortable with Trump. They like the idea of America being for quote-unquote Americans, and they mean by that white Americans, and Israel being for the Jews.
Yeah, well, that was the same positions in Germany.
Right.
Germany should be for the Germans, and the Zionists were perfectly willing and did collaborate with the Nazis to get people not safe from Germany, but only safe if they went to Palestine.
Uh-huh.
But
Michael, what do you think of Suarez's statement? I'm really curious about your response.
I agree with it, actually. I'll give you another quote from Suarez and ask you what you think about it. He says, true anti-Semitism in the United States is embraced by Zionists because it is inevitably pro-Israel. Is this true of Vice President-elect Pence and the Christian fundamentalists that supported the Trump-Pence ticket in the last election?
I'm not sure. I didn't see that on the part of Pence. I've certainly seen it on the part of a lot of Jewish Zionists, like Yoffe, whom I just quoted, saying that she was glad about all this anti-Semitism. I see the Christian Zionists as not being as fervent about Zionism as the Jewish ones. But that's my perspective.
I think that Pence and these truly fundamentalist Christians mm-hmm. who want the Jews, they're for Zionism. They want the Jews to leave the United States and go to Israel.
Yeah.
But the next step, which doesn't get much publicity, is then they want them to convert. And if they don't convert, they're finished.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, their view that the apocalypse only happen when all the Jews convert.
Yeah, exactly.
That's got to happen. Yeah, they have that religious belief. Well, I guess I wonder how many of them believe that stuff, because on the Jewish side, there's certainly a number, a goodly percentage of Orthodox people who believe all that claptrap and hokum. But I guess I wonder if there's similar percentages, that there are rational Christians out there who maybe support Israel and don't know the full story, but don't go in for all that conversion and rapture.
I expect that's true. I certainly hope so.
Phil, tell us, what has been the impact of Mondo Weiss since you started it a decade ago?
We are part of a movement in this country that of raising consciousness about the Palestinian conditions. And so our impact is a very shared impact. It's not something we have done on our own, although we began inside the American progressive Jewish community, we've extended to a broader community. We're part of a much larger movement. And so you see Electronic Intifada, which speaks for the Palestinian diaspora often, but is news-oriented, having a lot of impact. You see Jewish Voice for Peace, which is a non-Zionist and in some cases anti-Zionist movement inside the Jewish community, burgeoning because it is speaking up for Palestinian rights. You see the U.S. campaign to end the occupation changing its name after 10 years of existence to the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights, openly embracing an agenda of Palestinian rights. And, of course, you also see realists on the other side, beginning with Walden Mearsheimer, and their book, The Israel Lobby of 2007, preceded by the paper, The Israel Lobby, and the London Review of Books, a good left-wing publication of 2006, you see realists who are saying, we've got to change policy on this issue. So I think there are a lot of, I remember in when we studied French Impressionism, you had the Salon de Refusés of all those painters, like Cezanne and Picasso, or who were rejected at first by the Academy and became the biggest deal in art. Well, I think that you've seen this kind of group of refusés, rejected people in American foreign policy who were complete outsiders and marginalized during the neoconservative, neoliberal era, who are now beginning to come inside in one way, or forcing their ways inside over the last 10 years. And it's largely a coalition on the left, and you can see its impact inside the Democratic Party, where last summer, part of the Bernie Sanders insurgency was a movement to honor Palestinian human rights. I think it's a very broad movement. I like to think that we've had a big impact inside certain sectors, but we're just part of a big movement.
Phil, on a personal note, what led you away from mainstream journalism to put out the Mondo Weiss blog?
Well, I was 50 when I started this website as a blog, and I was in the mainstream media then, and I was not that serious a person, and I guess I just feel really grateful that the internet came along and offered me this opportunity to develop. And at that point, when I was 50, a lot of things had happened. The Iraq War had started, and I went to Israel for the first time in 2006 after I started this blog, and these things just forced a deeper consciousness on me, and I had been part of the trivial chattering elites until then. I had derived a very good income by working for mainstream media and doing pretty fluff personality profiles and glossy magazine stories about, you know, my sex life, and it was a pretty shallow existence journalistically, and I am, I guess you could say that I was forced into history by events, and I changed my company from elite Ivy League journalists to people like you who are have been engaged in thinking in a critical fashion for decades, and this made a lot more sense than the analysis that the neoliberals had. And so, inevitably, because I began to look into these questions, I was sort of thrown out of the mainstream media, and that's just fine. I think that my path is a lot like a lot of other journalists who have started to question the principles of the war on terror and of the American imperial enterprise. And and also of Zionism. So I'm very glad that all these things happened to me. It's been wrenching. I mean, it's a personal, obviously very subjective, but it's been wrenching, but enormously satisfying. And I think that something that you would have anticipated, Michael, is that I did find myself in a totally different cohort. And these are people who are enormously serious and enormous, who have just the best political values. There have been times that I find it a little too grinding and serious and tedious and just righteous, but that's just what political, you know, it's just, that's the nature of struggle, is that you're involved with people for whom this is everything. And I feel like I've gotten to be part of a movement that's similar to abolitionism in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. It's just a noble, noble thing that is happening in our society and around the world, and I've gotten to be part of it.
Well, Phil, we're so glad you are part of it.
Thank you.
And it's, as always, been a delight to have you on.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we'll speak again. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Take me away from this lonesome town.
With the election of Donald Trump and his selection of the deeply reactionary former prosecutor and senator from Alabama, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, as the new Attorney General and Chief Law Enforcement Officer in America, the progress in drug policy reform we have had over the last several decades is likely to be reversed. 28 states have legalized some form of medical marijuana, and a number of states, including Washington, Colorado, and most recently California and Massachusetts, have legalized its recreational use. But an aggressive Attorney General could reverse this. "Good people don't smoke marijuana," said Sessions last year. He also said that he thought that the KKK was okay until I found out that they smoked pot. Federal law puts marijuana in the same Schedule 1 category as heroin. At his Senate confirmation hearing, Sessions would not promise to defer to the states the decision to prosecute people using medical marijuana sanctioned by state law. He also supports mandatory minimum sentencing, which fuels mass incarceration and disproportionately targets people of color. Ethan Nadelman is the founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan was described by Rolling Stone as the point man for drug policy reform efforts and the real drug czar. He is widely recognized as the outstanding proponent of drug policy reform both in the United States and abroad. The DPA is the leading organization in the United States promoting alternatives to the war on drugs.
Ethan Nadelman, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
What is the mission of the Drug Policy Alliance?
Well, basically, it's to end the war on drugs as we know it and to move our drug policies in the U.S. and around the world away from their heavy reliance on criminalization and the criminal justice system and towards drug policies much more grounded in science, compassion, health, and human rights.
And what progress have you made in the last several decades on both the state and the federal level, Ethan?
Well, I'd say the most dramatic progress has obviously been on the marijuana issue. I mean, if you look, there's probably no issue apart from gay rights and marriage equality that has evolved so rapidly over the last 15 years. In fact, almost in tandem, if you look at the Gallup poll on support for legalizing, you know, marriage equality and for marijuana legalization, they both stood at about 34% back in 2004, and they're both in the high 50s now. And we're not quite as far along on that issue as is marriage equality. We don't have the White House's clearly or the Supreme Court or things like that. But let's look at it. Over half the states have legalized medical marijuana. That's over a majority of the country. Eight states have legalized marijuana more broadly, and California is the big one right there. There's huge support for this, and you know, we'll talk later about how Trump might interfere with that. I think the momentum is powerful. On other issues, like trying to roll back mass incarceration, we really led the way on that, going back to the 90s with ballot initiatives in California and elsewhere. And I'd say now there's a growing consensus that we just have too many people behind bars and that we have to cut that back, and especially with nonviolent drug offenders. And it's not just a progressive issue anymore. It's really crossing over. And on the third issue we work on, which is treating drug use and addiction as a health issue, we still have a long way to go in that area. We still have a lot to learn from our allies in Europe. But I'd say we've come a long way compared to 20 or even 5 or 10 years ago.
Ethan, speaking of the new administration, should we be nervous about the new Attorney General, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions?
More than nervous. Jeff Sessions, I don't know if he'd appointed Giuliani instead of Sessions. I think it would have been different types of nightmares, right? But Sessions in the U.S. Senate has been one of the most regressive, the most problematic, the most opposed to any types of drug policy reform. I mean, even among the Republicans, he stands out as an outlier. You know, the only good thing we can track down that he ever did was 6 years ago when President Obama pushed to, you know, pull back on some of these very harsh laws regarding crack cocaine. He did join that coalition. But apart from that, he stood in the way of sentencing reform. He's tried to block the marijuana reforms at the state level. I mean, he is about as retrograde as one can be. And although he's going to have a lot on his agenda, the fact of the matter is he's going to appoint people in the Justice Department. He's going to support aggressive U.S. attorneys and federal judges who could really, you know, they won't roll back everything we've accomplished, but they'll definitely, you know, push back in ways that are going to be problematic and a challenge that reminds me of the challenges that we focused 10 and 20 years ago.
Well, what can he do as a federal law enforcement to states who have decent marijuana policies? Can he impose federal law on those states? I know he said when he was interviewed, when he was nominated, he said he wouldn't do that. But what do you think?
Well, remember, he didn't say he wouldn't do it. He said he would enforce federal law. And federal law, remember, all of these developments at the state level remain technically illegal under federal law. So the very significant thing that President Obama and Attorney General Holder did in 2013 was to essentially give a qualified green light for Colorado and Washington to proceed with their marijuana legalization laws that had been passed through the initiative process at the end of 2012. And that was really historically significant. You know, the president cannot tell federal law enforcement folks not to enforce federal law, but they provide guidelines and they provide incentives. And that was really important for this whole thing opening up and a lot of the progress we've made. Now, what Sessions can do is to basically start to throw wrenches into the works. They can begin to pick out some high-profile targets. And in the same way that, say, President Bush and Attorney General Ashcroft did with Tommy Chong, the counterculture, marijuana guy who then became, got involved in producing water pipes back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And just be really horrific, you know, apply the ugly power of the federal police apparatus to individuals who don't deserve to be treated that way. He could stand in the way of congressional legislation that tries to give states more ability to do what they want to do there. And as I said, in terms of the people that he appoints, you know, there's a big difference between a U.S. attorney in any one state who says, hey, this marijuana legalization thing is working out pretty well. We don't see big problems. It's better than we had before. This will be one of my lowest priorities, as opposed to a U.S. attorney who pulls together a team and says, how do we get these guys? And in that sense, it could be really problematic. On the bigger stuff around policing and sentencing reform, there's less that he could do to mess with what the states are doing. But in fact, they could, you know, go back to this whole notion of just providing unrestricted funds to state and local police agencies, much of which gets can land up just being used to, you know, arrest many more nonviolent low-level drug offenders of this sort who shouldn't even be in the system in the first place.
Ethan, do you think there's a racist element to making marijuana illegal? And is there still a racist element in the application of the drug laws, interests, prosecution, and sentencing?
Of course, yes. I mean, racism has permeated the war on drugs and the prohibitionist approach really from its origins. If you look at the origins of drug prohibition in this country, they go back to anti-Chinese sentiment, the xenophobic sentiment in the 1870s and 80s. The first cocaine prohibition laws were about prejudice and fear of black people in the South. The first marijuana laws at the state level were anti-Mexican and anti-Mexican-American sentiment in the Southwest and the Western states. So this has permeated our policies. If you look at the way these laws have been implemented and who is disproportionately targeted, I mean, I think the most obvious case of this is that if you were to randomly stop 100 young black men and 100 young white men in any city in America, roughly the same percent of young black men and white men would have a little weed in their pocket. But in every city in America, the black men are 2 to 10 times more likely to be arrested. So there's a sense in which the laws have always been enforced for all sorts of ways, in ways that are racially discriminatory and biased. It's also the case that it's hard to imagine that America would have become the world's leading incarcerator. You know, we have only a little more than 4% of the world's population, but over 20% of the world's incarcerated population. And if most of the people being locked up on drug charges had been white people, I don't think there's any way we would have had the political support for these laws going back to the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So, you know, while it's true on the one hand that millions of white people are also getting the hell beat out of them in this drug war, and we can't ignore that fact, and Latinos are being disproportionately affected as well, there's no question that anti-black racism has been huge. And also, by the way, I should say, not just the United States. You see racism and ethnic bigotry and xenophobia permeating drug policy in many, many other countries around the world.
I just wanted to add a quote from Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. He said that he used to like the KKK until he learned that they smoked pot.
It was a bad joke he made in the 80s, and so I always take into account the fact that this guy said that thing 33 years ago, half a lifetime ago for him, and that he was joking. But that said, when you look at the pattern of his behavior in engaging with the criminal justice system, when you look at his gross indifference to the ways that these laws have been enforced and implemented, you know, when you look at the sorts of policies, I just think that when it comes to undoing the racism that permeates the drug war, Sessions is a nightmare.
Ethan, I understand that marijuana is still classified in the same category as heroin. What's wrong with this?
Well, it makes no sense whatsoever. Then again, heroin should not be in the most restrictive session either, although for somewhat different reasons. I mean, the fact of the matter is both of these substances have legitimate medical value, right? We know that heroin is prescribed in foreign countries in order to, both for pain relief, and there are now a half a dozen foreign countries, including Canada and a growing number in Europe, that allow people who have been addicted to street heroin to go into clinics and get legal pharmaceutical heroin, which they can't take home. And the results published in all the top scientific journals show that that has been effective in reducing death, disease, crime, and suffering, and saving taxpayers money and advancing public safety. So for that matter, heroin, you know, and some of the psychedelics, none of these really belong in this what's called Schedule 1 category, which is defined as drugs that have a high risk of abuse and no legitimate medical uses. But with respect to marijuana, what makes marijuana distinctive is not just that it has such obvious medical benefits. Just last week, the National Academy of Sciences came out with a major report pointing to these medical benefits in many areas. But beyond that, it's the fact that it is, as a DEA administrative law judge said many years ago, perhaps the least dangerous psychoactive substance commonly used in human society. Now, that's not to say marijuana is safe. I think we all know people who use marijuana and have a problem with it. You know, marijuana can be associated with some type, you know, early onset of schizophrenia. Nobody wants their teenagers waking and baking and, you know, going to school. So marijuana is a real drug, and we shouldn't joke around about the negative consequences of it. On the other hand, the vast majority of people who use marijuana have no problem for themselves or for the others. You know, it's compared to alcohol and tobacco, it is dramatically safer for most people who use those things. So, I mean, but we don't believe marijuana should just be rescheduled from Schedule 1, the most restrictive, to Schedule 2, which has cocaine and methamphetamine in it. We basically believe that marijuana should be descheduled, that basically the federal government should repeal marijuana prohibition in the same way that a ballot, you know, a constitutional amendment and congressional action repealed federal alcohol prohibition back in 1933.
Yeah, because it's a Schedule 1 drug, it makes it hard to do medical research on it. But what are the medical benefits that have been discovered so far on marijuana?
Well, I mean, it's kind of across the board. I mean, there's very obvious evidence vis-a-vis pain relief, vis-a-vis anti-nausea for many people, vis-a-vis controlling the symptoms in things like epilepsy and multiple sclerosis. There is, on the issue around glaucoma, that's a bit more mixed. For some people, it turns out to be an anti-anxiety medication, whereas others, it doesn't work that way. For some people, it's helpful for sleep. But I'll tell you this, the most remarkable stuff, there's now about a half a dozen studies published in the top referee journals over the last couple of years. And it's not by advocates, just by scientists and researchers. And what they've shown is that in the states that have the easiest access to marijuana, typically through a fairly easy access medical marijuana system, those states have seen the biggest declines and the lowest problems with pharmaceutical opioids. That the number of people dying of overdoses related to pharmaceutical opioids and using them in combination with alcohol and benzo-type drugs, that those are lower in those states, that the unnecessary prescribing of painkiller drugs. So there appears to be a very strong relationship between easing up on access to marijuana and reducing problems with opioids. Nobody has yet proven that there's a causal relationship between one and the other, but all the circumstantial evidence suggests that there is. Meanwhile, you also have it now being allowed to be recommended by doctors for PTSD. And so this has become a major issue with veterans and others. So, I mean, there is, notwithstanding the fact that marijuana is in Schedule 1, which makes it harder to research, the fact of the matter is that there are thousands of studies out there and from around the world that demonstrate, you know, the efficacy of medical marijuana.
Ethan, can you talk a bit about harm reduction as a way of handling drug abuse and addiction?
Sure. Harm reduction is the basic approach that says we need to try to reduce the negative consequences of drugs by and among those people who continue to use drugs, whether because they like to or whether because they're addicted or what have you. And so it's thinking, I mean, it first emerged around needle exchange, that people who injected drugs were spreading HIV and sometimes other infectious diseases. And it wasn't that drugs spread HIV. It's not even that syringes spread HIV. What spreads HIV is when people, you know, share the syringes and one person is infected, right? And so expanding on needle exchange programs and improving access to sterile syringes through pharmacies, which is what most countries around the world have now done and much of the United States is now doing, became the sort of prime example of harm reduction. But for people who have a hard time getting their mind around harm reduction in needles, think about designated driving norms. You know, if somebody's getting drunk, make sure somebody's sober who's driving. Think about motorcycle helmets. Think about switching from smoking cigarettes to using a e-cig or a vaporizer in order to reduce the harms of the burnt particle matter, right? Think about any dangerous or risky. Think about, you know, motorcycle helmets, bicycle helmets, anything that reduces the risks and harms associated with an activity or a drug or anything that can potentially be harmful. Now, when you have more people in America dying of an overdose involving opioids and typically the combination of opioids with alcohol and tranquilizer drugs, you know, what we've been deeply involved in is making available naloxone. Naloxone's a miracle antidote for an overdose. Somebody overdoses and you administer naloxone, and they basically, it reverses the overdose right away. And it saved that saved tens of thousands of lives in this country already.
Ethan, as we go forward in this brave new world, what are the plans of the Drug Policy Alliance in the upcoming Trump administration?
Well, with respect to, remember, most of our work, you know, Drug Policy Alliance, we're 75 people working around the country. We have offices in New York City and New Jersey and D.C. and Denver, Colorado, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Los Angeles and Oakland. So a lot of our work is at the state and local level. And we're first of all, we're going to be doubling down on our efforts to change drug policies in those cities and in those states that are most receptive to these reforms. And at the same time, doing an increasing amount of work in places like the South, which are still very retrograde on drug policy, but where the reforms we do may not break any new ground conceptually, but can affect a large number of people. At the federal level, it's really, I think, two approaches. I mean, one is trying to do harm reduction vis-a-vis the Trump administration. This is a very dangerous administration for purposes of drug policy and criminal justice. It's obviously a very dangerous administration in a zillion different ways. And so part of what we're going to try to do is to prevent them from rolling back many of our reforms and not getting in the way of our progress. The other part of it is going to be to take it, you know, to look for the opportunities where, I mean, look, the silver lining on this nightmare of the incoming Trump administration is that it's going to focus our efforts. To the extent that, you know, a more receptive administration with Barack Obama led to, you know, greater dissension in a growing movement, I think we're going to see less dissension and more focus about how do we keep this thing moving forward. And the other thing we learned this with Giuliani back in the late 90s, we've seen it elsewhere, inevitably, a highly aggressive administration like this overreaches. They do things that offends not just those of us activists, not just of those of us who care about this issue, but that offends the ordinary American. And when the Trump administration, when Jeff Sessions, when they overreach, we're going to mobilize hard to take advantage of that as a learning moment for the broader American public and to try to reverse the momentum of the administration.
Yeah, and we'll be here helping you, Ethan. If I might I ask you a personal question? How did you get involved in this kind of work?
If you want to see an interesting thing, watch my TED Talk, you know, which I gave a couple of years ago at the International TED Conference. I talked about that a bit here. But for me, it was really, you know, growing up in a fairly traditional family. My dad was a rabbi. We were Sabbath observant. Going to college, you know, beginning to smoke marijuana, wondering what the whole fuss was about and why people were getting busted. You know, reading John Stuart Mill's classic On Liberty and wondering why this was the business of the government at all. And then just beginning intellectually fascinated in why was this incredible disparity between what all the evidence, scientific and otherwise, said should be a good drug policy and the direction this country was going in the late 80s with this crazy drug war. I sometimes say what happened in the late 1980s on America with drugs, it was like McCarthyism on steroids. And that's what led to this, you know, problem of mass incarceration in America. We were not a mass incarceration country until the 1980s, really. And that's where we went, you know, crazy. And I happened to be in the right time and place of working and focusing on this issue when the drug war went crazy, and I started to speak out about it, as did a few other brave souls, a mayor in Baltimore, Kurt Schmoke, some right-wing intellectuals like Milton Friedman, William Buckley, the head of the American Civil Liberties Union. And, you know, we stood up and said, this is crazy. And we don't know if legalizing all drugs is the right answer or some drugs, but we need to move in a different direction. We need to recognize the extent to which so many of our drug problems are, in fact, the results not of drug use per se, but of a failed prohibitionist policy. We need to understand the extent to which the analogies to alcohol prohibition really do apply today. And it just became, you know, the calling in my life.
And we're very lucky for that, Ethan.
Well,
how can our listeners learn more or be in touch with the Drug Policy Alliance?
Just go to drugpolicy.org. We got a great website. Sign up for the our emails, e-newsletters. I mean, you'll get hit up occasionally for money. You can ignore those if you like, although please don't. But that's the best way to stay involved.
Ethan Nadelman, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Ethan. You take it easy.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.